You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Joe Muto on his book, An Atheist in the Foxhole. A liberal's eight-year odyssey inside the heart of the right-wing media. Also on the program today, what if you were the president of Bolivia and you were flying in your plane and all of a sudden some of the largest European powers said, we're not going to let you fly over us because we think that you might have someone who's been charged with a crime in America on your plane. What would you do? More on that as the show continues. Also, student loans officially have doubled as of yesterday. North Carolina, the latest state to ram an anti-abortion, anti-choice. Just really the latest on an attack on a woman's right to get health care in a last-minute session. Bradley Manning case continues. The prosecution rested yesterday in Egypt. We are just about at the deadline that the military gave to President Morsi. Protests, millions of people continue to protest in that country. The Obama administration announces yesterday that the employer, and I don't know that I would call it a mandate, but the employer penalties for not providing health care to your employees will be delayed a year in its implementation. We will discuss the implications of that. Marco Rubio, riding the wave of this anti-choice, anti-women, I guess, wave that is rippling through the Republican Party now, is going to co-sponsor a similar bill in the Senate, trying to cover his right flank for all of his, I guess, his immigration non-heterodoxy. All that and more on today's program. Just an update on the massive protests that were in Turkey a couple of weeks ago. A Turkish court has now blocked the building of a mall in Taksim Square. And so that was at least the, I don't know, the straw that broke the camel's back in Turkey, or the inciting incident of those protests in Turkey. Meanwhile, another story, apparently there was a bug in the Ecuadorian embassy in Great Britain. Not terribly shocking. We will talk details about that in just a moment as well. Folks, just a little bit of house cleaning tomorrow on the program. July 4th, I wish you all a happy 4th, celebrating our Independence Day from Great Britain, where we overthrew the notion of a a monarchy and the idea that you could have things like just laws that would be made up within the court of the king without really any participation from its citizenry. Keep that in mind tomorrow while you're eating your hot dogs, your burgers. We will be providing a members-only show from the deep, deep archives, 2004. You ready for this lineup? It is Yola Tango, Gary Hart, not together. Gary Hart did not play, and Bolivian playwright. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the name. But that will be for members only tomorrow. You will get to see just how little I have improved in my broadcasting skills over the past 8 years. And then on Friday, we will have a new show for everyone. Interviews, some interviews I did at Netroots Nation, one with Barney Frank, and one with the great Shannon Moore, the premier liberal talker in Alaska, on a fight that she's been engaged in for over a year now on saving Pebble Beach in Alaska. So that will be available to everyone. And then we will be back with our regularly scheduled programming. Well, I guess we're still on schedule, but our more typical programming on Monday, Matt and Mike Mondays, continue through the hot and hazy summer. And then I will return on Tuesday, probably with less sleep than I'm even getting now, because I think we're getting to the point where we're going to try and sleep train Saul. So I don't know how that's going to go. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Joe Muto, the mole in Fox. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Joe Muto, the author of An Atheist in the Foxhole, A Liberal's 8-Year Odyssey Inside the Heart of the Right-Wing Media. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be here.
I am I'm very excited to talk to you because for much of your tenure at Fox, I was at Air America, and particularly back in the day, we spent a lot of time wondering a lot of, you know, having been in an outlet that was perhaps most most like the liberal challenger to Fox back in that day. We were always sort of curious what was going on in that building. I have to ask you a question right off the bat. I suspect I know the answer, but back when we were doing Air America, we actually had somebody who was in contact with us from Fox, particularly I think it was in 2004, 2005, who at one point sent us the Fox News Christmas holiday party invitation, because this is when the war on Christmas was raging. Was that you?
No, that was not me. That's funny though. It was an anonymous person within Fox.
There was another tiny mole there. I don't know if you guys ever met in the lunchroom or something.
We had a weekly mole meeting, actually, but we all wore hoods and masks. So
right, the partisan underground at Fox. All right, well, so it wasn't you. Okay, all right, fair enough. If you want to just, if you'd rather just cough twice. All right, well, so it's 2004, right? Is that when you started there?
Right, I started, summer 2004.
Okay, involved were you? How politically aware were you? I mean, how did you end up going to Fox? I mean, you obviously have liberal proclivities, but was it a dilemma?
Oh, yeah, it was a big dilemma. I was sort of a aimless college senior in early 2004, as many college seniors are. And
to Liberty University?
I was at a University of Notre Dame in lovely South Bend, Indiana.
All right. I was making a little joke. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I couldn't fully hear you. I was looking around for a job, and I knew I wanted to be in New York City, and I knew I wanted to work in media. And, you know, other than that, I really sort of had no idea what I wanted to do. So I sent out a flurry of job applications, and Fox were the ones who responded. I mean, you know, I was basically ignored by everyone else, I think, and Fox responded. And you know, I knew their reputation, and I had eyes and ears, so I knew what I knew what they were all about. And so there was a dilemma for me. You know, do I really want to get in bed with these people who, you know, stand for many things I disagree with? But I told myself, you know, I would give it a couple months, and to my surprise, I found myself, you know, not entirely repulsed by it, and maybe even liking it in some cases.
What did you like about it? I mean, it was just a decent place to work, I guess.
Well, the politics of the place I hated, obviously. I was not along with that. But aside from that, as you probably well know, working in broadcasting can be a very exciting, engaging experience. You know, it's you get to cover different things every day, and there's always sort of a new challenge. It's never boring. And at least when I first started, you know, in 2004, during sort of the second half of the Bush administration, Fox really had sort of lost its focus on politics, especially after, say, Hurricane Katrina, when the Bush administration started going pretty terribly and people were sick of him. They stopped doing politics almost entirely.
Was it more cultural in the way that they were looking for stories? I mean, you worked for Bill O'Reilly the whole time. Is that right?
I started working for him about 2.5 years after I started at Fox. So I bounced around on a few other shows before I worked for O'Reilly.
Okay. So you missed the whole Andrea Macris thing.
I wasn't on his staff for that, but I was at Fox for that.
I should tell people Andrea Macris was the Bill O'Reilly producer who it appeared, we don't know for sure, but based upon the detail of the transcripts that she released, she had recorded phone calls where O'Reilly was calling her and talking about how he wanted to loofah her and put baba ganoush and falafel, I guess, all over her body in the shower, something to that effect. What was going on inside Fox when this was blowing up? You're brand new there. What was happening?
Well, first of all, that was all anyone could talk about for like 2 weeks at Fox. That was every work related discussion turned to that somehow. The first day it broke, I'll never forget this. It was on the Smoking Gun website, and the Smoking Gun website had like a very distinctive colored, like orange or yellow, I forget what color it was, background. So you looked around the newsroom, and every single computer screen in the newsroom was reading this lawsuit at once. It was just a sea of orange computer monitors, people reading this lawsuit, and like, you know, little, you know, people would burst out laughing, or, you know, it was a very weird sort of tense time to be there. And then at a certain point, the day the lawsuit broke, O'Reilly actually came to the newsroom. And, you know, he customarily would just walk, he'd walk through every day and sort of on the way to meet with his staff. And he came in the newsroom. He sort of paused in the entryway there, and it was just dead silence. You know, we could hear a pin drop, and everyone was just very suddenly very, very engaged in their work again. You know, everyone was very studiously trying to not look at him or at least not make eye contact with him as he walked past. So, he walked right past me that day, and he just had this look on his face like, do not mess with me, you know, like pure rage on his face.
And so did he give a speech? Was there any official addressing of this to everyone? Like, for instance, you know, we're blocking the Smoking Gun site, or nobody raises, you know, there's no Middle Eastern food to be brought into the offices for 6 months or something like that, or what?
Well, later when I was on a staff, we were always scared to order from the Middle Eastern restaurant because you'd not want to get overheard by him ordering a falafel sandwich. That would, you know, who knows if that would set him off or not. But it was weird. There was never any company-wide communication as to how we should, as a company, handle the thing. I heard from people who were on his staff at the time that, you know, obviously they were completely consumed with it, and he was having, you know, closed door meetings with the lawyers, and, you know, he was just angrier than usual that entire time. But nobody knows exactly what the terms of the settlement were, but presumably the producer got a big chunk of change and a pretty ironclad non-disclosure agreement, because you've never heard from her again.
Yes. I imagine she's sitting now on the coast, the Côte d'Azur in France right now, sort of just, it's all behind her now as she looks out to the ocean. And so the other thing I want to ask you about, O'Reilly sort of fascinates me, in part, again, because, I had done a show with Janine Garofalo, and she was one of those people that O'Reilly loved to have on and really intimidate and berate in the run-up to the Iraq war. And he really, from the stories that she would say, he really seemed to be a little bit of a maniac. I mean, what was he like as a person?
Not an unfair description, I guess, but if that was her experience of him. He was in person, and, you know, to his staff, he's like he is on TV, but he's less gregarious, I would say. You know, on TV, there's a certain element of joviality to him, and he's, you know, he's sort of outgoing and backslappy. But when he's off air, he's just as angry as he is on TV, but none of that jovialness, really, that goes out the window. So it is the strange thing about him is not that he's angry; it's that it takes so little to set him off. So you're constantly on eggshells around him, because you never know what's going to tee him off and you know, get you screamed at.
That's basically, you've just described what goes on in this office, actually, as well.
I mean,
to be fair, how much of a true believer is he? I mean, you know, he strikes me as a guy. I mean, one of the things that in the moments that I have talked to some of these right wingers, people of this ilk, who particularly TV personalities or radio personalities, a decent portion of them, you know, basically just approach me with like, "Hey, man, it's just about game day. You know, let's just, you know, it's, well, you know, that's just, we save that for the field. And, you know, this is, that's part of what our shtick is." How much of that is him, you know, when he's talking about the war on Christmas, for instance, how much of that is real?
He believes 99% of what he says when he's on air. I know the type you're talking about, that earlier type. That's like Sean Hannity is like that. He'll just make the argument, even if he knows it's a BS argument, he'll just make the disingenuous argument to make a point. O'Reilly will not. O'Reilly really believes almost everything he says. You know, sometimes he'll play it up a little and maybe take a slightly more outlandish position than he actually believes, just for sake of argument or to make something interesting. But really, he will almost never take a position that he doesn't mostly believe. He's, you know, I think that separates him a little bit from the other right wingers. And also, when he holds a grudge against someone, it's not for show.
Right.
Like he's still mad at Al Franken.
I was going to ask you about that. No, the hatred between them. I mean, particularly from O'Reilly. I think Al is just sort of like enjoyed messing with O'Reilly because I don't think he liked him, but I think he just enjoyed getting a rise out of him. There was an exchange that they had at a one of those like book readings on C-SPAN where O'Reilly got really, really angry at Franken. Tell me more about that. How much? Because Al, I think, just Al named his show the O'Reilly Factor for the first year of it, just to f with the Franken Factor, to mess with O'Reilly.
Yeah, that was really funny. I remember that. You know, Bill takes things very, very personally. You know, he truly hates Franken. He still, all these years later, and he's so mad that Franken got elected senator. That pisses him off to no end. You'll still hear him like lamenting it sometimes. Like, God, I can't believe Franken is the friggin' senator from, you know. So he's still mad about that. He's still mad at, you know, Olbermann. he takes these feuds very, very seriously, and I think to his detriment, because all he did was give more attention to Al Franken and has sold, you know, a million copies of
Definitely.
That book he was pushing, and all he did was increase Olbermann's ratings. So, you know, he doesn't have enough self-control to not rise to other people's bait.
And tell me about his secret security force that he claimed to have. I mean, I think at one point he said to a caller, like, you know, we'll send out. Who was he referring to?
He doesn't have a personal security force that I'm aware of, or at least not one that he deploys to get other people. When he says that is the like Fox News or News Corp security team. So we would have to, like, if we would ever get a crank caller, I would screen calls for him on his radio show. If we ever got a crank caller, we would have to report, you know, get the caller ID number and then report it to the Fox News security. And they would, I mean, this wasn't like a crack security team. This wasn't like, you know, CIA, NSA or something like that. This was like, you know, regular workaday security guards. So I'm sure they didn't like chasing down crank callers any more than I liked giving them the number.
But what do they do when they chase down a crank caller? I mean, we got crank callers all the time at Air America. I get crank callers here, or basically to this show, are basically how I almost make my living. But I mean, what does that mean to track them down? I mean, what happens once you give that number to the security force?
You know, not much. I think the security guys would sometimes call them and I don't know, maybe maybe give them a warning. Like, Bill's whole thing was he claimed that it was illegal to prank call a radio show, that was like, you know, phone fraud or something, you know, there was something illegal about it, which of course is preposterous, but that was his claim. So he would, we would give the number to the Fox security people, and they would, I think, call the person and say, hey, did you call, you know, the O'Reilly radio show and say something, you know, about falafel or Keith Olbermann on the air? And the, you know, the person on the other end would probably say, yeah, I did. What of it? You know, what are you going to do about it? Because there is nothing they can do about it. It's not like they were sending out, you know, goons to beat these people up.
So let me ask you this too, and I apologize to the audience for jumping around here, but because I've got there's so much that sort of fascinates me about what happens behind the scenes. So Joe, let me ask you this: I've always, you know, and we don't see much of it. I haven't seen many reports on this at all, the whole phone hacking thing in out of Britain. But it always seemed to me that if News Corp, essentially affiliates, if you will, in Great Britain, their security team had a methodology in which to crack people's voicemails, that it's hard for me to believe that the tactics they were using in Great Britain did not cross the Atlantic. How did people respond to what was going on with all that phone hacking in Great Britain? And was there any talk or rumors about the security force? Because it was also related, and I'm just trying to jar your memory here too, Roger Ailes, I know, used those guys to harass a guy who was working for him in a regional newspaper in Westchester.
Right. I remember that.
What did you guys hear about it internally? Anything?
I mean, we were all kind of aware that these things were going on, but it was not something that was coming out of the O'Reilly show in particular. I mean, there were always rumors around the office, and everyone knew that Ailes was, you know, pretty thin-skinned, I would say, and also, you know, more than a little paranoid. And would resort to these tactics, but that wasn't something that was coming from O'Reilly, I guess. So it wasn't something that we were aware of.
And would people around the office talk about it, or were you guys sort of, you know, sequestered in your own sort of like show pod, more or less, both like sort of socially and maybe even physically?
I think that's kind of a good description of it. We were sort of off on our own little show, you know, very small self-contained unit. You know, it would not surprise me to hear that there was, you know, sort of that level of phone hacking going on in the American operation. But I cannot recall a time when we ever, you know, information that could have been from a phone hack came across my desk. You know, like that's. You know, if there was something like that being done, it was being kept from, you know, producers at my level.
And but there was a healthy dose of paranoia there, wasn't there, about Ailes and sort of just internally. Am I right?
Well, yeah, we were all convinced that there were bugs in the newsroom, that there were, you know, there were listening devices embedded all over the building to catch people either bad-mouthing Roger or people expressing liberal viewpoints. So, you know, I didn't fully believe that, but I didn't completely disbelieve it either. That was, you know, it always seemed plausible to me.
Were there other people there who were expressing liberal viewpoints? It's fascinating to me just that there was that level of paranoia. We had some of that at Air America, but it was more that we were all convinced we were going to get audited by the Bush administration at that time. But the paranoia you're describing was actually from just your bosses there. Were there other people who were talking? Like, you know, would you have go to lunch and sort of say, like, boy, there really is no war on Christmas, is there? Or something like that?
Oh, everybody there knows that a lot of our things are like a joke, you know, like we used to use fair and balanced as a punchline. even the conservative producers there know that it's sort of all a gag. Nobody believes that our job is to be the fair and balanced news network. We all knew that our job is to sort of rile up the crazies who watched us. That we knew that. We admitted it, and we sort of laughed about it.
As things went on, and I imagine it changed after 2008 with the Obama election, and I know that it changed your perspective in some way as well, where it became a little bit less. It felt to you more like a hostile environment, but was there ever a time, particularly, you know, and I'm thinking about the Beck era a little bit, and you know, you mentioned Hannity. I know Hannity is just an incredible shill, but a shill I feel more in some ways for the Republicans in a way that I think O'Reilly is not. Was there any sort of give me a sense of, to the extent that there was a conflict within Fox about their role as sort of just stirring up the crazies versus, hey, this isn't good for the Republican Party?
Well, Fox went so far to the right after Obama was elected, and they did it in so many in such an odd way, and the shift was so fast that I think it surprised a lot of people. My perception was that O'Reilly sort of stayed where he was, and then the rest of the network went so far to the right that he almost ended up looking moderate by comparison. But you know, the network, Hannity's a good example. Hannity, I think, just made a fool of himself right off the bat, and you know, I think they waited. I think he waited all of 2 days to call Obama a socialist. You know, like it was so over the top for me that it was stunning, I think. And then at the same time, Glenn Beck had just arrived, and people, you know, he really shook things up a lot, Glenn Beck, because people did not quite know what to make of him. But his ratings were so big. He was pulling in enormous numbers for a 5 p.m. show. And, you know, people, there were rumors that he was going to take over O'Reilly's job, you know, and people really thought that he was, you know, on his way up. But, you know, and eventually, as it turned out, he was too crazy for anyone to deal with.
Well, I mean, tell me about the conflicts inside there, because I know, I mean, O'Reilly and Hannity, they don't like each other, do they?
No, I don't even think they're on speaking terms at this point. They just do not like each other at all.
And give me a sense of why. I mean, would O'Reilly badmouth Hannity to you guys, or what did you give me your sense of that relationship?
Part of it is competition. You know, they're sort of in direct competition as for ratings and for who gets which guest on which day. And you know, it's funny to see them like these two grown men scrapping over who gets Karl Rove, you know, on Tuesday's show. And part of that, another part of that is O'Reilly thinks that Hannity takes like digs at him sometimes, and Hannity is very good friends with Mark Levin,
uh-huh.
The radio host, and Mark Levin hates O'Reilly and will badmouth him on his radio show sometimes. So O'Reilly tried to get Mark Levin banned from the network, banned from, you know, doing appearances on Fox. And Hannity stuck up for Levin, and I think Ailes took Hannity's side, because Ailes and Hannity are sort of, you know, tighter than Ailes and O'Reilly. So that's a big source of the tension right there.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've noticed that Levin also had a big problem with Glenn Beck as well. There was, it's hard to know exactly what is at the grounds of these things, but they're all sort of bat crap crazy. I mean, did you ever have any experience with Hannity to give us a sense of what he's like? Because he is a liar when it comes to, I mean, and he will go on and you have a story, I think, in your book about the $50 muffin or whatever it was. But I've seen Hannity many times just, I know, outright lie about things like that. But when you get him off air, he also believes that we're living in end times, and this guy's a hardcore sort of fundamentalist type. But what did you ever experience from Hannity?
I mean, he's pretty shameless. I agree. That always bothered me more than anyone else on the network. Off the air, I didn't have that much experience with him. He spends actually very little time within the Fox News building because he is always at his own radio office, and he sort of just comes in an hour or two before his TV show starts. So he's not. I didn't deal with him personally that many times, but there is a sense that, I mean, he was just always a hack to me. That always bugged me about him, is that he would say anything and he was just completely shameless about it. He was just a shill for Republican policies, and he would go so far as to reverse himself from one day to the next.
Another question that has been weighing heavily on my mind: how drunk was Megyn Kelly and some of the other folks on election night 2012? There is no doubt in my mind they were drinking there.
I believe that. I believe that. There's, people went on the air, especially as you get to the later shift, people would go on the air, you know, with three or four drinks in them all the time. That was pretty common, a lot more common, I think, than people realize. And Megyn Kelly, she can put them back. She is, you know, I had some experience with her early in my career when she was still like a Supreme Court reporter, and she filled in on a crime show I was working on as the host. And she, you know, she was fun. She came out with us after the show and was, you know, buying everyone shots and stuff. So she knows how to hang. I would definitely, you know, believe that she was drinking on election night.
What were people saying about election night 2012? I mean, the next day, was there a scuttlebutt in the office about how messed up people were or what?
Well, I mean, I was unfortunately shown the door in early 2012.
Oh,
so
I
missed most of the fun stuff. From an outsider's perspective, or I guess from someone who worked there but and was watching the election from an outside perspective, what surprised me the most about the election was that Fox was sort of the dog that didn't bark, right? I mean, everyone expected them to, you know, go full force against Obama, and I guess they did to an extent, but they really, it felt like they never laid a glove on him, you know?
Right.
I mean, the big thing, what was the big thing that Hannity came out with? It was, this video is a bombshell. And
yeah, this is when he hugged his professor in 40 years ago or something like that.
Right. It showed him hugging a guy. And then he had another one where it was like, oh, this one will blow you away. And it was Obama speaking with a slightly, you know, slightly blacker accent, you know? Hannity, I think, made him a fool of himself and tried to build up these things into something they weren't. And, you know, but that's been sort of the right strategy against Obama the entire time, is there's no way that Obama can ever live up to the caricature that the right has painted of him. It's like this angry, radical socialist who wants to destroy the country. I think the country looks at that caricature and then looks at the reality of who Obama is, and they say, well, no, that's ridiculous. He's nothing like their, you know, his enemies are saying he is.
Now that was when you started getting disenchanted at Fox. At what point at one point, I guess, in mid to early 2012, you decided you wanted to work for Gawker. Tell us how that sort of came about, what it was the final straw, and then give us the saga of how you left. Because I remember seeing the mole stories on Gawker, and that was pretty short-lived. tell us how it happened that you ended up being shown the door.
I think calling it short-lived is actually being a bit generous. I think it was like, you know, a microsecond or something, how long it lasted. What happened was I was in late 2011, I decided I just couldn't be there anymore. I couldn't stay at a network that had gone, I think, so far to the right in a very ugly way that I I just didn't want to be a part of it anymore. So I started looking for other work. And in the course of that, I hooked up with the Gawker people. You know, my original plan was I would go to them and I would, I'd write for them after I left Fox. You know, that was the original plan. When I was meeting with them, they proposed that I write for them while I was still there. And my, you know, dumb big ego kicked in and says, yeah, of course. That's a great idea. Why, you know, what could possibly go wrong? So I started writing for them anonymously, and I gave them a few videos. And, you know, that's what did me in eventually, actually, is the videos. I gave them a video of Newt Gingrich getting his hair done by his wife before a segment. And then I gave them a video of Mitt Romney talking in the commercial break with Sean Hannity about how much he loves his pet horses.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, obviously not groundbreaking videos that were going to bring Fox down from the inside. That was never, I guess, my intent. But that is what led to me being caught so quickly. It was an electronic video system, and they could sort of, by process of elimination, figure out who had looked at these videos. You know, like, and it turns out I was the only one in the entire company who had looked at the videos. So they caught me by process of elimination, I guess. And you know, that was, I think it was about 36 hours start to finish before I was outed.
Did you have a moment to say goodbye to O'Reilly? I'm curious how that goes. I mean, just like you're brought into the holding cell in Fox and then you're just thrown out the back door. Or did you ever say goodbye to Bill O'Reilly?
I never did, actually. It was a pretty unceremonious exit on my part. They just, at the end of the day, yeah, I thought I was getting away with it. And, you know, because the day was almost over and they hadn't, you know, goons had not come to haul me away. But with like 5 minutes left in the day, they came and got me and brought me up to like the, you know, one of the executive's offices and sort of grilled me for an hour. And then two security guards just took me to my desk, let me pack up some stuff, and deposited me on the sidewalk. So I never got to say goodbye to O'Reilly.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's very upsetting, but it's probably best because I, you know, he would have put me in traction. I think if
did you guys have any type of personal relationship? I mean, for instance, like I try and keep at arm's length from the guys here in my office. I know that. So I would imagine it's a similar dynamic. But did you have any sort of, did he ever ask you like a personal question?
You know, he is one of the most socially awkward people I've ever met in my life. And this is going to sound weird, but it's almost like he's shy, believe it or not, in social situations. Like it was always very awkward for us when he would come out with the staff to our, you know, our outings after work that we'd have sometimes because he doesn't drink. He doesn't, you know, or he doesn't drink alcohol of any kind, not even a glass of wine. So he would just sort of stand there and make everyone uncomfortable. And we'd all loosen up a little after he left. But I worked for him for 5 years. We had a very small staff, maybe 15 people, not a lot. And I don't think he asked me a single personal question in the entire time that I worked for him. I think maybe once he asked me if I, you know, it was a holiday weekend, and he asked me if I was going on vacation anywhere. But I think he just wanted to use that as a segue to talk about the new house in the Hamptons he had just bought.
Now, to be fair, he probably had a dossier on you anyways. He probably didn't need to ask you any questions.
I always wonder about that, if he knew that I was a liberal the whole time, because a few other people on the staff sort of figured it out after the 2008 election. And I always wondered if O'Reilly knew or not. I think with him, though, he wouldn't care. Even if he had known, he wouldn't have cared, because no one's opinion on the show matters but his own, you know?
Yeah. Well, Joe Muto, really fun stuff, and the book is a great read. An Atheist in the Foxhole, A Liberal's Eight-Year Odyssey Inside the Heart of the Right-Wing Media. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right, Joe, we're going to say goodbye, and I'm going to say hello to those of you who are going to be joining me in the better half of the program. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Coming up in the better half of the program, going to fill you in on Egypt, on this complete story about Evo Morales', the president of Bolivia's plane, basically being prevented from flying out of Russia and in some ways forced to land in Austria because of a suspicion that Edward Snowden may have been on board. I mean, this is, I'll tell you, but this is, I think, just stunning. And we will also get to what's happening in North Carolina. This sort of the third state now in just a number of days, which has either attempted to and en route to, or has successfully passed legislation by a Republican-controlled government, both houses and the governor, to all but deny women their rights. And by that I mean they pay lip service to a woman's right, but they make it impossible for her to exercise those rights. And we will talk about that. It's sort of ongoing in North Carolina. This is more about what Moral Mondays has been about there. And for those of you who listen to the better half, you know Triangle Bill from presumably the Research Triangle in North Carolina has been giving us updates on this for quite a while. And so it's just stunning. And it seems that the Republicans have, in for a penny, in for a pound, they're going to push this on a national level. And I really don't see a whole lot of daylight between what they're doing in this instance in curtailing women's rights and their what appears to be their decision now to use, even to heighten racial polarization even more as a way of driving white votes come 2014 and then presumably 2016. We will talk about that in the better half, as well as the delay in the penalties that will be imposed on employers of 50 people or more if they do not provide health insurance to employees. This one is, from a policy standpoint, the short story is, from a policy standpoint, I don't think such a big deal. From an optics standpoint, more problematic, and what it may reveal about the capacity of our government to implement this law, it also may be a big problem. We'll talk about that in the better half. I will take your phone calls. I will take your IMs. And now I will say adieu to you. Don't forget, become a member at majority.fm. Become a member, folks. We need your membership. The app is coming. I promise you. And it's going to be great. But it's not going to be free. I mean, it's going to be free for you, but not for us. Also, support this program by, if you buy Amazon junk, whatever that junk is, books, movies, rototillers, whatever that junk is, buy it through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Buy your coffee from justcoffee.coop. It's great coffee. It's a co-op, employee-owned. They were very supportive of everything that went down in Madison. They are fair trade, so everybody gets paid fairly along the supply chain. They've got great coffee.
They give you 10% coupon code. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. They have a Majority Report blend. You don't have to go out and lug pounds of coffee back from some people who don't give a crap about fair trade. You can have it sent directly to your home. It's win-win-win, folks. JustCoffee.coop. And also give us a review on iTunes over the week. Hopefully you got tomorrow off, and then maybe some of you, if you're lucky, Friday. See you in the better half.